now to the home stretch. We're going to be trying to put a few things together, and I will be making some specific, we're going to be looking at some specific details, but also will every now and then I will just make some general remarks that are associated to things we're seeing. So that just to give you the impression that there is much more to the theory than what we have been covering, what we can cover in this amount of time. Some things you'll see later on in the courses. There are two further courses you could take. I think at least one of them is voluntary, or is one of those you have to choose. I'm not sure about the other one. So one thing I just wanted to also to start today is we may be under the illusion that Einstein equations are easy to solve because we went in and solved for Schwarzschild. We also went in and solved for a spherically symmetric distribution of matter, and we described the full spacetime that way. But remember, that was under a very, very highly idealized scenario. We asked for staticity. We asked for spherical symmetry. And in doing so, well, we ended up with a solution that is very useful, though we'll say a few more things today. But I mean, it's a very special solution. In fact, depending on how you consider regard physics, anything in physics that is static is boring. Nothing is happening. And so then you have to question the solution you've gotten. How do you know it's useful? It may be that it's the end state of a given scenario or a set of scenarios. Under generic conditions, you may end up with something that looks like the solution we have obtained. And if so, it's great. Then you are able to then say at least what the end state of the system will be. And that's very useful and has very practical consequences. But we still don't know unless we do something more. We need to kind of explore a few things further with the theory in more generality and understand what may transpire. So I'll say a few more things. This is a theory, and I mentioned at some time last week that solution, Schwarzschild in particular, had to be unstable just from very easy arguments of saying, well, if that object were to accrete any angular momentum, now we'll have rotation, and we didn't have that in our, we didn't allow that in our construction. So the solution, the analog solution to that, is known as the Kerr black hole solution. Incidentally, maybe off the record, I'll tell you something that will contrast it when we talk about gravitational waves, how different referees might act when they get a paper. It's a very interesting exercise on human nature, but I'll do it with the mic off. So Kerr finds his solution, and it's a solution that, okay, if you squint and take A to zero, A is a parameter, we'll discuss what it is in a second, you recover the Schwarzschild solution we obtained. But this one has angular momentum. So if you measure at infinity, not only the test particle, but also the influence of this A, it makes it rotate, even though you didn't give it, say, initially any angular momentum. So the particle will acquire some effective rotation that is known as frame dragging. So it's something that when you look at the solution, this is one of the things you take. The reason I put here some gold is that solution has many, many interesting features. So I'm just picking a few to tell you about. You don't need to write anything about this. It's something you'll see. It's also in the paper, in the workbooks. But I just want to use this as a contrast with what we have seen. So if you find where the horizon is, where our r equal 2m is, now it changes into this. We find that there are two places that were akin to what we define as a horizon in Schwarzschild. One that goes m plus square root of m squared minus a squared, and one with a minus. So we have an inner horizon and outer horizon. For physical kind of discussions, we always think about the one outside, the one with the plus. And again, you see that if you take A to zero, you recover it to M. But of course, the first thing you notice is that what happens if A happens to be larger than M? So here you have an imaginary number. And what happens is that now you have a singularity that is larger or it will be visible in your spacetime. So you believe, if you assume that singularities should not be visible by observers, that then A has to be bounded with M. It doesn't have, that parameter never exceeds the value of M. And it's an interesting exercise to try in dynamical setups where you have some angular momentum in the system, you collapse to a black hole to see if you can actually find out a dynamical process that will exceed that bound. And so far, we haven't been able to do that. Any system that has been studied dynamically where you actually collide or have a star that is highly rotating and you make it collapse on its own, finds a way to expel angular momentum, throw it away by different mechanisms, so that when you form a black hole, this bound is satisfied, which is actually pretty interesting. And there was this conjecture.
Yeah.
No, then there is the ergosphere is even further out. So the R plus is where the horizon is, and the ergosphere is some distance out. I'll say a few more things. So there's a conjecture. So there's a question. Yeah. Hold on. Just a second. Yeah. That in principle, so if I evaluate, so if you take that A larger to M, and you take the curvature invariant again, you're going to see that the curvature blows up at a radius that is larger than where this thing is, or where this, because this is imaginary, so now we don't have a real number, but it would be in principle accessible to any observer. Or if you want, you can go to that space-time arbitrary close to where your Hirschman is just blowing up, and you trace null rays, and they go all the way to infinity, so an observer would be able to see that somewhere in your space-time, the curvature is just growing out of control.
No,
now it's not. The singularity is sitting at, so it's now it's in a ring, and as you increase its A, grows or gets larger and larger in size, and now it's in principle gets out of any observer. So the limiting case is to think A goes to M, so you have a horizon, and the horizon, at the horizon, your curvature is blowing up. That means that epsilon away of the horizon, you could send rays to infinity, and an observer will see if that observer is measuring somehow the curvature, that the curvature is about to blow up.
So you have like a d minus one dimensional singularity.
The singularity structure is much more complicated, so we're not going to go there, but yeah, so if you want, then we can show that in detail. It's much more complicated to understand it, but yeah, it's not an effective point, it's something that has a volume.
I don't understand. You have 2 points at which your metric is blowing up.
No, careful. Remember, Schwarzschild had a place where the metric blow up was R equal to zero, but then there was an R equal to M that we saw that was fake because it was a bad choice of coordinates. So here you're saying where, yeah, the horizon, you have two, and then you can change, do the same exercise, and realize that if you, as long as you keep A smaller than M, it blowing up at this radius meant nothing. It was just meant a bad choice of coordinates. But as you choose A going to M, then you see that this curvature will blow up. And so then that's why you think, oh, if I believe somehow that I don't have visible singularities in my spacetime beyond the consequences of the Big Bang, then there has to be, nature doesn't want to go and make this object that has an angular momentum parameter is too large.
If n was bigger than 1 or bigger than m, so that would mean that we don't have a horizon and also no singularities?
So, okay, you have to form it. So this is similar to the case we're discussing the sun. There's, oh, the r equal to m is inside, but that's the metric doesn't apply there. We go in and we find the metric of the star. You could do the same thing now with rotation. You say, well, if this object that is rotating this fast were to collapse on its own, conserving its angular momentum, which we cannot define very rigorously, but I mean, to some approximation, we can make sense of it. They said, oh, this will produce an object that has A larger than M, and we will be in trouble. But then you ask, like, what really happens? Then you make it go so, and what you see, as it goes, just like the ice skater kind of spinning on in place, as you try and do that, let's use example, we keep using this example of the ice skating. So if the ice skater, if there was a bound, you will see that the ice skater now has his or her arms ripped apart and they fly out to infinity to carry out all the excess angular momentum so as to form a black hole that doesn't exceed that A. So that's what happens with the star. As it's collapsing, it realizes I'm going to have too much angular momentum. It is as if nature says that. And then it says, okay, I need to get rid of some of it. And so the outer layers get blown up, and they carry a significant amount of angular momentum that leaves the object that you do form with that bound satisfied.
That's what's going to happen every time.
That's a strong question, and I'm not prepared to answer it that way. Every case that we've seen it so far shows that, which would have that would strong backing to put that, but it's a conjecture. So there's a conjecture about the what's so-called the ultimate state conjecture. The ultimate state conjecture says, if you form a black hole, however you form it, but it will be described by this solution. And so far, every examination that has looked into this has seen that the excess angular momentum gets thrown away, and then you form this object. Let's go here.
What if I observe a black hole without angular momentum, but some of them with rotating? So.
Well, okay, then we go into the question that was earlier. You have to make sure that now you're going to measure something in a sensible way. Yeah, if you are now rotating, you may think, let's see, you would have to, I don't know what would happen in that case, but I would say if you want to now say, how much angular momentum does that space frame have, or that object that I still don't see, and that we can't see the black hole, so I'm just measure its effect on its surrounding, and we put a particle that would define the right frame so that it don't contaminate with my own motion, and then measure it. And again, so far, it seems to be the case that we never exceed that bound. Any questions here?
I think I saw an article that had me kind of confused about people observing a black hole that was kind of putting out like stars that have had like kind of, you know.
I don't know what you're...
Is it possible that it was just like... That was just kind of the excess angular momentum, and that matter was just sort of on the edge, and it was just...
So, okay, good. So now as it to his question. So another thing I was going to mention. So let me just say a few more things, and then at some point we'll start the class. So we have, because we have rotation, now you have broken spherical symmetry. There is a preferred kind of sense of rotation. And so you want rotation co-rotating with the black hole. And so then everything we discuss about orbits with Schwarzschild, now they begin to sense where I'm going, against the flow or with the flow. So we have prograde and retrograde orbits. So in particular, in Schwarzschild, we saw that there was this kind of stable circular orbit, last stable circular orbit at 6m. That was for spin zero now, because this metric does contain Schwarzschild when you take a the parameter to zero. Now, if you think what happens when a is different from zero, then we have two classes, the prograde and retrogrades, and then these six. Now bifurcate, we have two possible values, which depend on the parameter a over m. And if you take the extreme case of a over m going to one, then the 6m retrograde orbits, that orbit, the stable orbit goes to 9m, and the prograde goes to m. And also, notice the horizon decreases all the way to m. Then associated, remember we define an energy. We could define energy. We have a killing field, a global killing field. We said, okay, the product of this with, say, the particle's momenta define an energy for us. But in this solution, because notice now we have cross terms in Prager, when you evaluate this, there is the energy. That energy becomes negative. So there's a region still outside the black hole, but close enough to the black hole itself, which is what he was asking, ergo region. Or ergosphere, this thing become negative, and associated to perhaps your question, then an observer at infinity would see that something seems at odds, because I have a particle that I knew has positive energy, now it goes inside this region, it seems to have negative energy, so what happens? So the energy budget of the system is weird, and then one can then associate to that some potential instabilities or ways to extract energy from the black hole. And if you have heard of the Penrose process, or black hole jets, or things like that, are associated to thinking that this process is, or this phenomena is linked to that. Again, we're not going to look into this. And then finally, as I said, as a larger name is singularity. On that, let me just mention one last thing that we only briefly touch upon. So there is, you have heard perhaps of the cosmic censorship conjecture. So it's a conjecture. No, there is nothing proven about this, which states that any singularity in the space-time will be hidden inside of our event horizon. So that is kind of a get out of free jail card. But it says, well, at a singularity, we don't know what to do. The physics, as we know, breaks down, which would say that if the singularity, if you have the singularity somewhere here in your space-time, some singularity were to arise there, you would expect that the physics on its in the future domain of influence is not tractable. Because you're an observer here with your all your physics laws that you think you'd control, you're doing experiments, and all of a sudden you enter this cone of influence of this object. So we don't know what would happen there. Unless, of course, this singularity is hidden by horizon, we're an observer outside, and so then we'll be safely doing physics as we think. So the cosmic censorship conjecture is just a censorship of saying, oh, we think if this happens, we can keep doing physics as we know. And so we have, if you want, observe a naked singularity or a singularity. That's the Big Bang. Out of the Big Bang came dragons. And then those dragons gave us the laws of physics that we know and we have constructed. And so far, we've been successful. We don't know if there were another singularity to pop up somewhere in the space-time where the same thing would happen. So out of here, anything can happen. And so it's not clear if the physics laws in here would be the same. So you could be this observer doing everything that you know and love, and everything works out, and all of a sudden something breaks down because of the information that came out of here. If everything were hidden by a horizon, then okay, then you'll still be safe. And then, similar to the question that you had before, every time we have tried to form a singularity that is naked, that violate this cosmic censorship conjecture, it has been extremely fine-tuned in 3+1 dimensions. In higher dimensions, it's not the same thing. But in 3+1 dimensions, it has required some very, very special initial conditions, and therefore we think this is non-generic.
So, there are exceptions to cosmic censorship conjecture, but probably never
You would expect, yeah. So they are. If you use those results, you would say that those exceptions are so finely tuned that you don't expect nature to realize them.
Sorry, I may miss that. Places where the message blows up, or
No, these are the horizons. This will, if you were to compute where the horizons are, these were the horizons. And there is an outer horizon and an inner horizon that.
When A is 0, it's just R equals 0. Well, one of them is 0.
Yeah, but then that's it. That it doesn't apply. I mean, if you want, that's a singularity of your ship. Yes. A is the angular momentum parameter of the black hole. Okay. Let's start. So now we want to then go and try and ask some more about our space-time and how do we go about understanding it. So far, like we worked on the geometrical structure first. Then we obtain some solutions after deriving the equations. We obtain some solution. Then we're arguing those solutions are very special. So how do we make sense of dynamics in the space-time? So we're going to be trying to discuss that this week. And as we do that, we're going to then discuss gravitational waves, the true degrees of freedom of the theory, and that pretty much will contain the information of the course. And then Aldo will describe for you a little bit about black hole thermodynamics. And then there is a little bit of a connection of quantum gravity, so that would be fun as to wrap this up. Okay, so first we're going back to well, we're going to try and understand some dynamics, and just as we did it as we started the course, we're going to try and go slowly. First, what we can do, we're going to assume that the space-time's curvature is still very weak, and then kick it up a notch by considering now. There can be some dynamics, so let's explore how we even understand that. So remember what something we said is we're going to consider the metric to be given by our flat metric, and for simplicity, we're going to assume this is a flat metric in Cartesian coordinates, so it's minus 1, 1, 1, 1, plus some linear perturbation. And here we're going to say, that's what we determining, or the assumption is that this tensor, every component in any coordinate system that we care about that is consistent with this being the flat metric represented in the way I mentioned, is much smaller than 1. We also described that out of that, that assumption, the inverse metric can be written this way. Of course, we would have higher order terms, but we're only keeping things to first order, so this is fine to the order we're working. And if we plug in into Einstein's equation up to the first order in H, what we picture or what we can see is that the Einstein tensor evaluated in the metric goes into, say, the Einstein tensor evaluated in the first order perturbation of the metric, and then we proceed as seeing now the equations and the equations of motion for these H's. And to the order we're working, these H's happen to be tensors in their own right. So then what do? We proceed in the same way we proceeded before. We take Einstein's equations, we replace these, we keep the first order in the H's, and as a result, we end up, and this is an exercise, okay, we can, this is just something. So we know that the Christoffel symbols, for instance, which we have G, D, G's, again, I'm repeating things that we have already seen. Then we'll have contributions that go H, D, G's. And, but the D, G's, so we're going to have contributions that go like H, eta plus H, D of eta plus H. And then the derivatives of the eta are zero. We also have derivatives of H that are non-zero. And so therefore, we only keep to that order the eta times the D. Because then gamma is order H. Gamma squares are order H squared and can be discarded. And so once we put all that together, Einstein tensor is written, we end up with this equation, or where this is our, will be our tensor. And of course, if we have the right sources, then that's what we'll be trying to solve. But now what we're going to try is instead a little bit at this expression and try and see how we can kind of make sense of it. Remember that we still have freedom in our coordinates. We have the diffeomorphisms freedom. And we're going to try and kind of massage these in such a way that we can make the most sense to try and understand what the dynamics will be. So again, we're in many ways, we're just copying the same steps what we did in the past. But now we're looking into a slightly more general scenario. So first thing is we're going to introduce some convenience notation. So let's introduce a few new tensors or new quantities. Some we've already seen, like this one, when we did our weak analysis, weak gravity analysis, we already introduced this thing that we knew we could link to the gravitational potential of our whatever source produced by your source. We're using this to encode or re-encode H0, zero. We also can introduce now something for here. So this is if I'm sticking the T and then I'm just only letting I vary. We already have something for 0, 0, for 0, I. Let's introduce a vector. That's wi. And for hij, we can keep it this way, and in some cases we'll do. So this is just for the purely spatial part of that metric, linear perturbation. But in some cases, it will be convenient to introduce two more quantities. So a quantity that will take, for me, the trace, and our quantity that will be the trace-free part. So this is, what is this? C. And this one is? Phi. OK, C and phi. That would be the last time I say it correctly.
What?
What J?
Indices.
Oh no, sorry. You want me to put a dot here? Yeah. Well, that's the problem. When I do that, then I can distinguish them. Yeah, that's what I meant. There's no capital. So where this S, so as you said, this thing, which I already forget how to spell it, how to pronounce it. I'm sorry, I'm not gonna be able to put that dot. Okay, so this S is a trace free of H, and this thing is a trace of H. So associated to that, to them, we can compute the Christoffel symbols. Do I want to write them all? I'm not going to write them all. They're in the book. By the way, this is chapters. We're looking at chapter 7 from Carroll's. I mean, the reason I'm not going to write them all is we're actually going after an expression. Once we compute the Christoffel symbols, the first thing we're going to do is geodesics. So we go back to our geodesics. So we imagine we have a particle that has momenta pa, which we know is like this bare mass. And it would be dt, d tau. We're assuming it's parameterized in an affine way. And then we have dxi, d tau, which we can write as m dt, d tau, dxi, dt, dt, d tau. And if I think of this as u0, that's u0 vi. And if I call e the stuff sitting on the first plot, this is the same thing as e vi. So with that, go back to the geodesic equations, and we write down its equations of motion for both the the temporal part, the zero component, and the I component. So, and then we get dE let me write the R1. And we know, because we're using our, we're doing everything to first order in the perturbation of the metric. Our metric that we use to raise and lower indices is a flat metric. So I can go freely up and down in the spatial indices. This one will, if I'm doing bringing up or down the zero, the t index, I'll pick a minus sign depending where it's up or down. But here I'm just using that. So pi. I have it with index up here, but notice it's coming with index down there. If we're doing things at all orders, this would be incorrect. Our abstract index notation, make sure that we have the indices, the free indices in the same places. So here, we kind of see some of the things that we worked out before. In particular, we looked at this component, the time derivative of the acceleration. The acceleration is in here. Here is the gradient. This was the mass. So here we were recovering our Newtonian expression. But when we kind of look into a more general scenario, we see many more pieces coming in. In particular, there is an interaction with the velocity of the particle with the metric tensor itself. So in particular, you often find this also expressed in a slightly different way by introducing. Yes?
You wrote on the second to left line. Is that D naught? D T of phi?
Yes. So this one?
No. The line above that. You wrote P0 times phi, which is.
Oh, P0 is E.
Is that really it, or is it the partial derivative
of respect? No. That was not right. Thank you. So now we just introduce this. And one can rewrite that equation as So this is just simply kind of a little rewriting of this expression in terms of this vector. But you can see that up to here, it looks like the Lorentz force of a particle with having some velocity interacting with some vector field and some acceleration component. Yes? Either one. Whichever, where goes first?
What's the little symbol? Is that like a uppercase lambda? So you see the H, above the line above. Yeah. What's the little symbol?
This one? Yeah. Curl?
Oh, that's lambda?
No, that's a curl.
That's a curl.
Yeah, so this is why I rewrote it here.
I just want to make it clear for myself. The way you derive those geodesic equations was that you just said, for example, the zero, so the dp zero d tau is equal to with the d tau is equal to the gamma function times PAPB. Sorry, gamma function. Christoffel symbol times gamma.
Right. So we did PA grad A. Yes. So out of that, with the metric expressed in terms of those concepts we introduced here, or those that re-expression of the H's, the only reason we're slowly building into that notation is convenient to pick up few kind of terms that we have intuition about, or at least it gives us something that looks familiar. So in particular, having introduced these things, right, the phi or phi and the vector omega, allows us to see that the equation of motion for the spatial part of the momenta has a piece that looks very much like what we would have thought natural, or would we know in electrodynamics for a charged particle moving the influence of some the electric field and magnetic field. So there is this sense in which these G's, the G's is referred to as the gravito-electric part, and the H is the gravito-magnetic part. But in addition to that, we also see that there are couplings with the velocity itself of the rest of the metric representation. And notice here we haven't yet found it any more useful to write in terms of the S and the phi that we introduced over there. That will come in a bit.
What was the motivation behind writing Hij as 2Sij minus psi?
Right, that's exactly what it said. So far we haven't used it, but soon we will. So this is what
I mean. Why did you write it in that? I mean, I know you want to plug in the equation, but why like that? Is it taking the trace out?
No. Okay, great. So you're jumping way ahead, but let's go there. So we'll see when we write Einstein equations for kind of an interesting scenario. So far here, we're just only analyzing the geodesic and how things look like. And so far, that decomposition hasn't been useful because it's somehow hidden here. But then later on, when we try and solve for a specific scenario, say a source that is distributed and is varying, and therefore it's maybe producing gravitational waves, that thing over there will be very convenient because the waves will be in the S. The gravitational waves are in the trace free part. And then another piece of kind of the initial value problem will be hitting on the phi. And then we're going to make contact with that. And then when we solve that a very specific case, we're going to have, as far as evolution equations for this, very simple, kind of very relatable equations for those quantities. Yeah.
What is the motivation behind this naming? Like, is it G and H, they're going to be like
perpendicular to each other? No, first you can see it here. So the way that thing comes, so if you think of a particle again, a charged particle that's moving under the influence of both electric and magnetic field, you have a piece that is proportional to the electric field. So in here, that's the analogy.
You don't necessarily have a charged particle. This is from like
no, right. But so in the part, so there in electro, so like if you want electrodynamics, it's determined by a tensor field, this And here you have a different transfer field for the metric. And so there you begin to see analogies, and this analogy keeps going. So eventually, when you look at the Bayel, the evolution, remember that Bayel tensor we introduced, can also be split into electric and magnetic parts. And again, the structure of the equations has a lot of reminiscence to what you would have that you already know in electrodynamics, plus some other pieces are true unique to general relativity. But given that this is a kind of a very it's a complicated theory, people have historically tried always to find ways to connect with things you already knew to try and build intuition. Okay, so now, yes.
What is V0 omega I there?
This is a time derivative.
For the definition of GI, because if it was just T0 phi, I have the intuition that that's like the great, the minus gradient of phi. And
So before you had that piece, now it's telling you that the time derivative.
Oh, that's like the DTA. So if you wanted to say that that's equal to the electric field, the first term is gradient of phi, and the second term is DTA.
You, if you want, you can think of it that way, but it also has some physics built in there because I mean, notice where it's sitting. It's sitting in the TI part. And if you come in here and then you think you're doing this for care, notice the angular momentum, I mean, one key important piece of the angular momentum is showing up here. So there is also physics, it's not just a gauge, but good. If you think want to think of it that way, it has some pieces related to what you're saying. Beyond that is to say, oh, once you look at how this came about, you recognize there are some things that kind of have a correlacy to it, some others that came kind of right through the vector field, and then you do this split.
The correspondence between electrodynamics and Einstein gravity. Could you say a bit more as to if it's misleading, how it is misleading, and if it's not, why it doesn't work as a unified theory?
As a unified theory? Oh, that was a very broad question. So let me just try and make it not as broad. So there is some connection in that, okay, one is governed by there is one vector field with 1 degree of 2 degrees of freedom associated to it, but it's spin one, gravitational gravity is spin two, it has 2 degrees of freedom as well. They both propagate at the speed of light. One has both charges, electrodynamics, the other one has only one charge. So there are analogies in structure and there are very significant differences. So depending on what the purpose of where you're going with that question, there might be lots of things to dig out, but. Well, one is a spin one, spin one field theory. The other one is spin two, and to the level where you can assume that you're applying to gravity has this weird thing that influences the arena where it acts itself, and that's just gravity. Electrodynamics doesn't have that. It relies on the back. An arena that is pre-given. So there are significant differences already there. But there are lots of connections as far as the mathematical structure of the theory. Both have kind of massless degrees of freedom associated to them that propagate at the speed of light. So you'll see that structure coming out again and again. So where did it go? Somewhere. I had a box.
And then,
the box on H is already very reminiscent of what you would get in electrodynamics, but that's because you're talking about massless degrees of freedom.
Okay.
Yes.
What we are doing is electrodynamics.
Yes.
No.
Unfortunately. Well, the only non-perturbative work is Go numerical simulation. Great. That's a question. We choose a very particular route of doing perturbative study. We said we're perturbing over a flat space-time, and then we're going to try and understand things there. The reason we're going there is because a lot of concepts will be very natural because we can make constantly contact with things we already knew from before, from special relativity. But you could say, I'm going to do perturbations over this metric. So rather than doing with the flat space-time, you're doing with respect to a black hole space-time. So this is there's a black hole perturbation theory. The beautiful thing of doing that is that you can, for instance, ask, is the black hole stable? So you that will come associated to that. If you then look at the modes as you perturb this object, and then the modes are all describing the exponential decays to equilibrium, then that's how you kind of build intuition that this metric is stable. And this is indeed how we know that we can rely on this theory, that we haven't written a solution that is completely relevant because a little perturbation will take us away from it. So that we could do. We could also do perturbations in cosmology. And so this is to kind of try and make contact with cosmological observations. But depending on the scenario we are, we have many different perturbative approaches. But if you want to do the full thing, the equations are complicated enough that you have to rely on numerical simulations. Then out of the numerical simulations, you might obtain some guidance as to what the phenomenology around some particular problem it is. And then that might guide a refined perturbative approach that captures much of what you want in an analytical way. But if not, the only method we know is numerics. Any other questions? So, who hasn't answered the three questions? People in the back. Go ahead.
I'm from Thailand. I like to read books
and my people. Cool. Everyone else has? Have you?
No. I'm from Thailand. I like running.
Running? Cool. Anyone else? They were all good? All right. Okay, so some more questions. Who's going to win the next World Cup that is coming? Brazil. Okay, so now let's. What we can do. What if I done it? Did I write somewhere? The Einstein tensor in terms of?
Yeah, it's metal late. It's really tiny up there. Very
tall. Oh, right. Okay, so now what we can do is take that and get the TT, TI, and IJ components. So let me start with a few. And we're going to make use of that S. G00. So notice I'm writing G, not the R. Before in vacuum we were working with the R. Let's write the Einstein equations themselves. Thank you. So we're quickly going to do something else with this, but let's just pause for, ouch, for a second. And let's imagine that you're trying to solve the problem. And you ask, just by looking at these equations, how many, and this, of course, they are all equal to something. You can say they're equal to zero or equal to whatever sources of energy you may have that has a, have a non-trivial precedent tensor. But you can see, like, so, oh, by the way, this operator is, it's just a Laplacian in flat space-time. So with the exception, for the timing, suppose I give you Sij even over the full space-time. Then you could come and then use that equation to fully solve for this guy phi. That guy. Then I can take that, now I know that guy, and I knew S, and then use this equation to solve for omega. And then I can come to this last equation. And then, okay, I would know this line. I would know this line. Yes, there are two times derivative here, but so be it. I knew it already because I have solved that thing before.
Zero, zero from?
Say again?
Zero, zero from?
These are Einstein equations.
Okay.
So we just use that decomposition and just plug it into Einstein equations and keep to first order in this, in H or in any of these tensors.
Okay.
If you do that, then the point we're trying to get to is that if I knew Sij, this equation we can use to just solve for, and notice that it doesn't have a kind of a box associated to it, it's just a Laplacian. So I can fully solve for phi given that source. Let's imagine that you're setting it to zero or to something that you know. Similarly here, I would know this piece and that piece, this because it's known, this because I just solved in that equation. And when I come in here, the same applies, where the only unknown is that field. And so what we conclude out of this is the, and related to your question, the true degrees of freedom are sitting in here. So even though we think we have 10 equations for 10 unknowns, then you remember, oh, there were four coordinate conditions we could still do, so are we having more equations than unknowns, etc. It is also the case that hidden in the structure of the equations, there is a lot of relations among the different components of the metric, if you want, which then explicitly state that there are only 2 degrees of freedom hitting on Sij. And then we'll see this more explicitly as we move along and maybe tomorrow. But what we're going to do next is to realize that we still have some freedom, because one thing we haven't used is,
Sij has 2 degrees of freedom or not three?
This is, because it's trace free. But we're going to go, just hold on to that. We're going to see this explicitly. So we still have the diffeomorphism freedom. So we know we can get HAB and change it into something by suitable choices of the Xi. So what we could do is then try and exploit that, and we'll do it by picking some particular conditions. So, and there are many. I warn you, there are many depending on the application you're interested in, or the type of application or the problem you're working with. So we're going to pick one that is especially nice for the purpose of where we're going to. And we're going to make connections with gravitational waves and the production of gravitational waves. So we're going to choose that. And so this freedom, I want to write this, allows us to do, for instance, Again,
it's the upper index.
Zero. Again,
zero
ci I c zero. And this is an easy way to know that this cannot be anything else because it has to be a fixed one, but doesn't have a free index here. So my free index is I, so there has to be the I index.
That doesn't make sense because I abstain.
Exactly, but this is why I said that we can cheat. We can do this fine because our flat metric is the one that we're raising and lowering. So as long as I'm not doing it with a T, I can ignore. I mean, the I, I can flip it up and down. Finally, okay, so that freedom allows us to change these by a judicious choice of z. So one particular gauge that is useful is called the transverse gauge. Transverse gauge. Which demands that Di Sij is zero. Which implies, if we ask that over there, the following. Having an Sij that is given to us, we can use this equation that comes out of that condition to find what is the spatial component of that vector z that gets the job done.
So we're going on with the cheating index again?
Yeah, we're through. Absolutely.
When Hab goes to Hab plus the symmetrized derivative,
No, so we can think of it in several ways. One way is to say, suppose you have a metric, so you have solved the problem somehow. You know that that metric, the solution to that problem would be unchanged, it would be exactly the same physical situation if you arbitrarily add this. So now we're saying, well, let's try and make use of that. And we know that for the right vector z, we could choose it such that a few things happen. So if for an arbitrary vector z, what it would do to your metric, it would change every single concept that we introduced before in this way. We say, well, let's just choose one that would make this happen. And this is just to say, can we assure that that will happen? Well, that will say there is the spatial part of that tensor, or that vector, should satisfy this. And yes, it's an equation we can solve. It's a Laplacian, it's a nicely looking equation. So we could find out what this one is.
Does the gauge freedom exist in general, or just in the
limit? We're in the limit of the weak field, and then we see that this equation now is under that assumption. The equation is well behaved, so we can find the integral of this equation.
So I meant to say, can we always do the metric goes to the metric plus some derivative of the vector field?
No, this is always true. So we have this diffeomorphism, this diffeomorphism is invariance of the theory. So this we can always rely on. Where we can this translate into that? No, this is very special. And we can also, we're also going to demand. So this we have three conditions here. We have one free one because we have four, and we're going to use this one, which again will say, oh, the time component should satisfy. So there is a gauge, or there is a set of coordinates where we can make this choice. Under that choice, we can go back to our Einstein equations, and then just peel off what the equations these are implying. So we're picking a very specific gauge, and then we're going to run with that.
Would you be able to write the box operator like you did the loop last year? Would it just be the same thing?
Yes, but I'm going, the reason I mean, this is also historical, so there is a lot of, say, math structure that we know as far as the equations are concerned. With the kind of, this is a nice elliptic equation, so we introduce that explicitly just to keep us, or remind us that, yes, the structure of this equation is something that's sufficiently nice that we now know how, that we can solve it.
And this is a different thing, right? We can't
use both. No, it's the same. We have here, we're using three conditions. These are our fourth. So we have fourth conditions. So notice what that implies once you plug in here. This one says you're going to fix the spatial parts of that vector, and this one will fix the temporal part of that vector. Yes?
The freedom of theory is to add a symmetric thing to the metric, or is that one only in the limit of the theory?
So this is in general.
Component to the metric, and you say that it is a gauge, and is the freedom of theory adding a symmetric derivative or a like complete derivative?
No, it has to be symmetric because this object is symmetric.
Yes.
But in what, sorry?
In the limit that we're working with a small h.
No, the diffeomorphism invariance it has. So we have made, okay, that probably was right to your question. This with the G. But we have made the choice of working on the weak approximation so that the freedom of the theory kind of imparts on the H the same symmetry. Thanks. So if that was your previous question, then I didn't get that. I was thinking of H as a G. So putting all this together is now, and this is related to, I think, the previous question. Now the set of equations change or simplify a lot by this choice into this. Seems like we kill everything. But we're also making kind of manifest what we already discussed. So it will tell us the Laplacian of that guy under this very special diffeomorphisms or this choice that we have made is that the Laplacian of phi is zero. Let's say we're in vacuum. We're assuming we're in vacuum space-time. So any energy that is floating around is only gravitational waves. So this means out of this, and assuming that asymptotically if phi goes to zero, that means that phi is zero. Same thing for this one. Sorry, this was probably I. This means that wi is zero. The same argument, and this means that phi is zero. So we have nothing from this, and the only thing that we have left is this equation. So if we give initial data that has some s here that is different from zero, and of course we also need to give the time derivative different from zero, let's say. So then we'll describe gravitational waves that propagate. They propagate at the speed of light. They are transverse to the propagation direction in this case. And it has only 2 degrees of freedom because they are trace free. Because so we go back to just use this and then plug that up there. And then you're going to see that everything begins to knock off. And of course, this in part of how this gauge was seen. I mean, you see that mess, okay, how can I simplify it? I realize I have four conditions that I can provide, and then I start doing things so that I can chop as much as I can from there.
So we might as well pick them to be zero?
No, I didn't say we might as well pick them to be zero. I said, this is an equation. We have it's a source free as far as the stationary tensor is concerned. So we're in vacuum, and we have asymptotic conditions that are consistent with the problem we're solving, which goes back to flat spacetime. So that equation goes back to the previous question. It's a nice elliptic equation, and you can use mathematical theorems that were said by the maximum principle. You can guarantee that there is a unique solution, and by specifying the appropriate boundary conditions, which will be phi equal to zero at whatever boundaries you have, then the unique solution is this one. And then the same argument says tuck, tuck. And so the only thing we have left is this equation, which, of course, if we were to write or set initial conditions where s and the time derivative of s is zero, then the only thing we just did is recover flat spacetime. But this one is saying, oh, in this, we can have gravitational waves that propagate through. And at this order, this is important to maybe say here in connection with what we discussed earlier, the equation of motion that we have is quite simple. And it will say that this S is not going to blow up. Right? Imagine that at infinity, S is sufficiently, also should go to zero. Or I give data in some compact support here. This will disperse away, and it will just give back flat spacetime. So one thing that we're kind of not rigorously proving, but strongly kind of motivating, is that flat spacetime is stable. Because we see that we can give some source and things. Suppose, let me give you a different example. Suppose we would have obtained this. Right, so this is consistent again with to linear order. But this equation would very likely, well, let me put a parameter here that I don't know what it is. I can promise, I can choose that parameter so that this S, as it evolves, blows up. Right? Because this is, imagine it's like second time derivative of S is some kappa time derivative of S. And then I can throw in, if you want, some another gamma of Sij. Again, all this is consistent. But now, the structure of this equation will get, for the right value of kappa, will blow up. So in that case, we have said, we started with a, and this goes to the previous question about perturbation. We start with a perturbative approach that shows that things peel off from that behavior. What we found here is, no, this is a very sane equation, which will say S doesn't blow up. In fact, our next step is to find out what the solution of S is.
So can you remind us here what the physical
size is? Right, so. Good, I'm glad. So I think as part of the course, I'm confusing everyone as to the pronunciation of Greek letters. Sorry. So remember this one, I know, phi with hat and bottom. So this one was something we related to knowing about the gravitational potential of, this, of your system in that gauge, right? We just found out we can make it zero. Now, this guy takes the spatial part of the metric and takes the trace away. So this is a trace part of S, of H, sorry. If I trace this, I will get that. So H II is that. And the trace free part of H is S. One, two, three.
Is there a way, so is the statement true that you can't simultaneously set the trace part? So the boundary condition being that psi goes to zero as we go out to infinity? Is that the perturbation around the flat metric dies as we go out?
Right.
But it's not. So if we allow for that, it's not at the same time possible to demand that Sij vanishes or vice versa.
Well, Sij just means the structure. Great. And this is also part of the reason the structure of the equation is very different. This is also why we said, oh, look, the 2 degrees of freedom are hidden here. Because this one, with only this equation and boundary conditions, I have the problem solved. And I know 0, 0, 0 because of this equation. With this, I don't know. I mean, I can demand that at infinity is 0, but that's not enough. My problem, the initial value problem for this requires me to give at a given time, you could say I'm interested into the future evolution, what the time derivative of it is, and what this, well, the time derivative of S and S at that given slice. So this is why this S is very clearly different from this other one.
Is there any reason to choose transverse gauge, not Lorentz like?
Excellent. So we're going to go there. You jumped way ahead from where it was going. The reason here, we're trying to simplify our life, identify the true degrees of freedom, and then try and find out what the solution is for wave propagation in the problem. Now, the Lorentz, we're going to get there in a bit when we try and then make a better contact with the physical meaning of these propagating degrees of freedom. But at kind of the underlying most important reason for this was to simplify our life. Look how an easy system of equations we end up with. But it's a choice.
Yeah.
And then we just,
the only thing that we assume here is that like, we have a perturbation on top of a like asymptotically flat spacetime, and any perturbation that it is going to give rise to such a propagation.
Right. We assume a little bit more than that, in that so not only that we recover asymptotic flat spacetime, but anywhere in between, it's very close to being flat.
But you're not assuming anything about the shape of source. Like, for example, anything our source is going to be, if it's going to produce any perturbation on top of the flat.
Right.
Source.
No, but here, I have chosen, or we have chosen, we're also in vacuum. If we were not in vacuum, then these things will acquire sources, and we're going to go there, and this is when we're going to go to the Lorentz gauge, because it will allow us to do a cleaner relation of a source producing gravitational waves and what the fields are doing, what the metric field will be doing. Here, we are postulating, we said God gave some gravitational waves that happen to be traversing these slices at any given time. And then we said, okay, from there on, we're going to analyze the system. But we didn't ask ourselves how were they produced. That's this is where I'm hoping we're going to get to, is to also connect with the production of gravitational waves still in a regime where it's consistent with our assumptions that we're sufficiently close to flat and nothing is firing too rapidly crazy.
Okay,
go ahead.
Can we see here, like for example, that non-rotating forces that cannot produce such a propagation, something like that?
No, we're not asking for the relation with the source. I mean, the source are gone. So you would have to ask, okay, how did you come up with these conditions? And once you ask that question, then you can relate to what the source is doing.
You said that we assume asymptotically everything goes to flat, but you have a wave solution, S does not go to zero.
So I could have, so this is why I said, imagine that better yet. I mean, I thought of that question. I mean, yeah, I can still do it, but let's imagine, because I still haven't told you how it will decay, so I can have it decay. But just imagine that you give it in a compact domain. So I'm going to put vacuum and zero. So S and time derivative of S are zero outside some domain, but then we have something here. And so then the dispersion will take care of what you just said. If as the waves disperse, pictorially you have some energy in a wavefront. As the volume grows, it decays, as the energy will decay as one over, as the distance gets larger, you just diffuse it from that point of view. So, and then yes, you recover flat space time. One can make rigorous sense of that.
So it can't be a plane wave.
So no, we're going to describe for plane waves, but the physical one would be, okay, so plane wave thanks all the way to infinity. Yeah, okay, so if that's your example, yeah, then we're in trouble. Or imagine anything that we can concoct related to natural sources will not be a plane wave. It will become planish as it disperses just because the radius of curvature gets larger and larger.
Where did you solve this equation exactly? Around an object.
We're not making the connection yet of that, but just imagine. So something happened here. So if you want, you had a star that collapsed on its own. and then afterwards it leaves gravitational waves. But of course, you say, well, where did the black hole go? Okay, so I imagine that's not what happened. But you could set up, what do I want to say, without adding things that we still haven't said. Let me.
So these equations are the linearized solutions to the metric everywhere, provided that something happened somewhere.
In the past, something happened that produced a
everywhere.
So far, yes, yeah, so we're saying everywhere. Yeah.
Because of what Vincent said, why would someone not say, okay, the plane wave equation works for this? And
no, in fact, we're about to solve for plane waves. But this is what we're going to do now is solve for plane waves. So plane waves are a solution. But his question was, oh, if I also want flat space, I'm at infinity. So then I started answering, well, in a real scenario or in a scenario that is natural, you would expect that you're not producing plane waves because plane waves extend all the way to infinity. And then you wouldn't say be saying, oh, at infinity, I have exactly flat space time because that's what I used to. To motivate this being the solution. So we're thinking that in some domain, the approximation of plane waves is reasonable. In fact, okay, that's what we're going to solve. We still don't know they're plane waves, but of course, that's what you're anticipating looking at that equation.
But plane waves go to infinity.
No, they extend all the way to infinity. They're moving that way, but they extend all the way to infinity. So how did I produce a plane wave? That's all I'm saying. If I have an infinite front of waves, how do they produce? I should have had sources all the way to infinity. So what I'm saying is to simplify your life and imagine this is only happening in a small domain.
But you're not acting it, but you're not, you're saying something happened somewhere. You had a source at some particular point. Doesn't matter. The solution
it could have happened
anywhere outside that object can be the
same way. So at earlier times, concept. At earlier times, whatever can happen, will happen for me to say I have some non-trivial value for S in some domain. That's all I'm saying. This moment, that's all I'm saying. We're not connecting with what the source did to produce that.
Okay, I'll ask this question later. You can take input that the standing waves may be if it is going to be at the boundary.
Again, what you're asking, we can't. Because flat space time, so at infinity, so to set up a plane wave, I need to be requiring that I'm not losing energy. And you will be losing energy. Energy gets lost if it goes to infinity and you're never to be seen again. So, yeah, so that we can't. You could, if you imagine that you have somehow put some specific mirror or something in between, but okay, that requires then some source that is actually somehow absorbing the energy and re-emitting it, which we don't know how to do. And so you can't shield gravity. Gravity will pervade everything.
So then, I don't know, it's a trivial question, but HII is equal to psi here?
The trace, this was just saying, this is a statement that the trace of H is psi.
Because if you multiply that by also that, if you look at that, that's HII is equal to minus 6 psi. And
the so HII just so this is
minus 3 psi, which is.
Okay, there's a 3 that I'm missing, so. Let me just make sure I didn't make a mistake there. Yes, and the problem is that there is a 2 missing. Here, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you got a 3, now you got a 6.
So the 2 equations can't both be right, right?
Which one?
HII equals psi, and the psi equals minus 1.
No, this one is
trace-free. No, but the top right.
Top right, this one. So that's a definition. I define this way. So,
but this can't be the same as
so take the trace. So let's HII is minus 5 times 2 times delta ii, which is a 3, which is then a 6. And then this one is that.
Okay, but so what you wrote at the bottom wasn't.
Oh, sorry, that's what I mean. So, no, so what I mean is h psi is a trace or contains a trace of h. That's what I mean.
Okay, that's
I understand. So h is there to contain the trace, and it has factors that were chosen so that you simplify things nicely when you express. So let me just say something quickly. Otherwise, we're not going to get to gravitational waves. OK, so the solution, just trivially out of that, the solution is our modes are propagate at speed 1, right? Because this operator is a minus dt squared plus Laplacian. OK, so remember also what conditions we have. So having chosen that gauge, we have strong conditions on the edge, which is a transverse condition. So it is the case that HAB now, when we look at it, or is satisfies a few conditions. First, H0 nu, or H0 A, B, is equal to 0. So it has 0 TT and 0 TI. So they are, the H is purely spatial. We also know that it's traceless. And we know that it's transverse under the gauge we constructed. So HAB has a structure like so. But for this reason, so we only have any non-trivial thing sitting in this purely spatial part. For this reason, the following notation is often used: dt, or transverse traceless. So to keep reminding us that we have made a very specific choice to make this explicit. The solutions, just 2 minutes, and then get to at least somewhere close to where we wanted to be. So the solutions, you can make the following ansatz if you want, and then just show that indeed this is true, that HAB So here is where the plane waves were just postulating plane waves, at least locally if you want, our solution. So we say if you put this ansatz and replace that into our equations of motion, what you find out is where Ka is some vector. So if you express or plug this in here, what you conclude is that the following has to be true. Right? Every time you take a derivative, a kappa comes down, but then two derivatives are contracted as a result. There is a contraction of this vector, and the only thing it's saying is a null vector, which we expected that to be the case. That's out of the equation of motion, but this condition also implies let's put dt here. So The equation of motion tells us the vector has to be null. The transverse condition also says that has to be orthogonal to the direction of motion. If the wave is moving this way, it's a wave that is orthogonal to it. So that's hence the transverse. So just one last observation, and then we'll finish today. So suppose the wave moves along z. So it's moving, just pick a direction, and in whatever direction moving, call it z, then our vector Ka will be given, and I'll just give you this now, and then where omega is the frequency of the Earth gravitational wave. We can then make that relation explicitly, but let's imagine this. So this K, under the fact that we have assumed that the that any contraction is done with the flat space metric, so this one satisfies this condition, and will satisfy this condition provided our CAB is something of this following form. The minus there. So to satisfy the transfer condition, then C has to be written this way. It has to be traceless, so whatever is sitting in the 1-1 has to be equal to the 1-1 here. And then the R1, because it's symmetric, we have this. And so here is where what we know of. I mean, we need to do a little bit more work, but essentially all the information is here, with the fact that the gravitational waves have two polarization degrees of freedom. And they are, if you have seen any publication on gravitational waves discovered by gravitational interferometers, this is what we're measuring. We'll make contact with that. So the next thing we're going to do is then take this solution that we have found, go back to our geodesic deviation equation, and show that indeed the effect of a gravitational wave as it passes by with respect to two geodesics would be to do this. And we'll analyze what this structure means, what the polarizations are. And you will see that associated to this, we will do that one, if we had a circle of particles, one of the polarizations will make that circle wobble. It will contract and expand in the other direction, and then go like so, and go up. And the R1 will just do that at an angle of 45 degrees. As a result of that, they are known as H plus and H cross. One, that's the motion in this direction, and the other one in 45 degrees. And incidentally, that's why gravitational wave interferometers are built on a kind of an L-shaped contraction, 90 degrees. You're trying to maximize. If what's going to happen is you're going to shrink one and elongate the other one. So this kind of geometry is ideal for that. Or just detecting that. But let's stop here and then we'll follow up.
So if log sub C is 0, and you know that the resistance is 0 in left hand, but the contraction of resistance is not.
Sorry, I'm not sure the Ricci's tensor is 0? Yeah, in vacuum. Good. So then? I just said, no, sorry if that was a conductor. So we need to solve for HAB. HAB has a number of unknowns. So in principle, we can say, okay, we have 10 unknowns here, but we have conditions. But we can try and postulate any solution, even that we see that the structure is a box, might be something that we can write as in terms of plane waves, but we still have 10 unknowns at this point. So I just postulate that. This is not the bio. So it's just a way to keep the unknowns that we are yet to determine in a matrix form. And also the bio, remember, has had four indices. This has two.
And box of C is 0?
The box of H is 0. Then we plug in. These are, if you want some constant at the moment, so the dependency in space and time is here. We're then trying to say what are the conditions on these Cs that satisfy. So the first thing, when we apply the box here, we find out that that K has to be null. Great, that we knew. Then the transverse condition tells us that K dot C has to be zero. Once we apply that, in addition to these observations that made it being purely spatial, we went from, so purely spatial means we only had that. Now, that condition, the transverse condition, and the fact that it moves along Z made, we had to have also zeros here in the Z direction, if you want. And then we only had a 2x2 matrix that was non-trivial. And that 2x2 matrix was not general either, had to satisfy the traceless condition. So these two components here are linked. And then these two, well, are the R modes of polarization. They are modal polarization. So we recognize the 2 degrees of freedom have that structure when written in this way. And then I go there.
When we're talking about this specific result that we only have 2 degrees of freedom came out from the fact that we're working in transverse space, right? But when we're talking about observations, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're sitting in this specific way.
Right. Great question, but that's so. The order is slightly different from the one you just said. So, this is so working in this gauge made it very explicit what it does. However, we already had motivated the 2 degrees of freedom before, simply by seeing the structure of the equations even before we made any choice of gauge. Right? Remember when we discussed that observation? Well, suppose I gave you S. And you determine everything else. And I said, well, if you did have S, then you could use that to determine phi, and then you can just go one after another one and realize, oh, while it is true that Einstein's equations had all these unknowns, the metric transfer has all these unknowns, what we're seeing is that the structure, at least in this regime of weak gravity, that if we give just a subset, everything else is determined by the equation. So they are very highly linked or correlated, if you want.
We can show that any gauge we use, we are going to only have 2 degrees of freedom, but they're not going to be orthogonal. But what's the advantage of using transverse gauge?
So the transverse gauge made very evident this piece, that gravitational waves are propagating orthogonal to direction of propagation, and what they do is modify things orthogonal to it. So as this wave goes that way, its effect is in the orthogonal direction. So that this gauge allow us to see that very explicitly. So that's the benefit of it, in addition to having a very simple set of equations to solve for. But as I said, related to his question, once we try to link it to what the source is doing, we're going to have to change the gauge ever so slightly. It's still not going to be very different, but it will make our things more natural.
So I'm realizing now that, okay, the satellite condition partly emerges out of the transverse gauge you chose. So the transverse gauge only comes over the spatial part. That one.
No, yes and no. You're right, but we also had the R condition. So we did here in the spatial part, but then we realized we can lift it to the full space just because the time components are not really contributing. So I can just do that.
Okay. For instance, you can write down the equation for S using all indices, including also the time index, because the time index is zero for S. So
that's right. That's right. So we could have done that, but
two questions. One is, so do you get Lorentz gauge out?
It's very close. Hold on to that question. We're going there. We must get there this week.
Okay. My second question is, the solution turned out to be a plane wave.
Yes. Yeah, but I can do a whole bunch of things. I can do a plane wave, but also we can, maybe there's something you didn't see in electrodynamics. I can build lots of things in plane wave. I can make data with plane waves so that I adjust things so that they cancel here. So I can use plane waves as a basis. So that would be another way of saying it. But again, this is, if you want, just think of it an ideal. So I can imagine the space M is infinite. I'm looking at data in a very large region that is still not completely the full space time. And within that large region, I'm looking at even a smaller region where the failure of a wave to be perfectly plain. I can't even tell. And so it's perfectly plain for me here, and then it hopper offs over there. Fine. But again, we're idealizing lots of things so as to have something destructible. I mean, I understand where you're going with your questions, but in order to answer it rigorously, we need more structure, which we don't have.
You said that because you see that the gravitational wave correlations are transverse to each other,
yeah, so that
is ideal for us. But I'm kind of confused because we use a transverse gauge. We postulate, so to speak, for them to be transverse. And then we saw, oh, they're transverse in this gauge. That's ideal. But
right. So it's ideal. So
the KACAB equal to zero is not necessarily zero everywhere for every gauge.
No. So with that we can prove. I mean, in general, you can establish that. But now this ideal for an ideally propagating wave. So if wave is propagating this way, yeah, that's ideal. But okay, nature doesn't have that. So then you end up doing if it comes at an angle this way. So then you have the appropriate projection of that waveform onto the plane of the detector. Okay, that is something that gets taken care of in the detector itself. So they are directions in the sky and propagations towards you that would make this detector completely insensitive to that waveform.
But if that equation is true in this gauge, we can always say that those two polarizations are
We can establish that. And great question. In general relativity, if we allow for beyond GR, then you have a much more complicated scenario. So then you can go from two polarizations all the way to the six that you could have. And this is part of also what the detectors are trying to go after. Okay. If your theory of gravity is not general relativity, remember we discussed a little bit the other day. Like for instance, one thing we said is we build our theory and the assumption of any coupling with our physics ingredient is minimal type. If that's not true, then what do? We violate, for instance, the strong principle of equivalence. So in those theories, this is not as simple. It gets complicated as you relax that. Okay.